So listen, your toilet is massively gross. Like, it's grosser than you think. In fact, bacteria and viruses can hang around in the toilet bowl even after multiple flushes. And I recently found the easiest way to clean my toilet. Blue Land Sustainable Toilet Cleaner Tablets. Just drop, watch it fizz, brush, and flush. It is truly that simple. No more scrubbing for hours. Plus, the tablets are plastic-free. Blue Land is on a mission to eliminate single-use plastic by reinventing cleaning essentials to be better for you and for the planet with the same powerful clean that you're used to. Blue Land products are effective and affordable, and their toilet tablets are proven to work on a wide range of toilet stains, including rust, mineral deposits, lime scale, and hard water. And you can even get more savings by buying refills in bulk or setting up a subscription. Blue Land has a special offer for our listeners. Right now, you can get 15% off your first order by going to blueland.com/dearhank. You won't want to miss this. blueland.com/dearhank for 15% off. That's blueland.com/dearhank to get 15% off.
Hello and welcome to Dear Hank and John.
Or as I like think of it, Dear Mark Watson and Hank.
It's a podcast where two brothers and sometimes a brother and a friend give you advice, answer your questions, and bring you all the week's news from both Mars and AFC Wimbledon. Today I'm here with Mark Watson. Mark, did you know that two vegetarians can never argue because they're not allowed to have beef?
I don't think that's that bad.
Okay.
I'm disappointed by how little I'm cringing.
Oh, okay. Well, you're a professional comedian, so you would know.
I guess the thing is, I also am a dad, so I probably have developed a kind of imperviousness to dad jokes now. Like, I'm kind of the target audience.
You're in it.
I'm in it.
What kind of children do you have?
I have a 12-year-old boy and an 8-year-old girl, so I'm now in a very poor position to judge whether a joke is good, because everything I do is embarrassing to them anyway.
Oh, no. That happens that quickly?
Well, yeah, but I don't even say that with too much regret. I think it's kind of... I don't think it's embarrassing in a way that they experience as bad. I think it's just like an expected part of the territory,
right,
basically.
Okay.
And at least being a comedian is cool for a while. There'll come a point where they're actively resistant to it, but that point hasn't come yet.
Okay, good. So I am aware of your work just by being aware of the British comedy scene, which I enjoy very much. So thank you for coming on to our weird podcast.
Well, thank you. I was surprised you were aware of who I was. And also I have to say, obviously I've listened to the podcast, but I'm not normally, party to all of the questions that come through.
Yeah, yeah. We sent Mark the whole doc. A lot of people don't even look. You've looked at all of them.
I read several dozen questions. The inquisitiveness and just the fun of them was, not a surprise to you, but it's you've got a great listener base there. Hello, everyone.
it is fantastic. And I feel it is the thing that makes the podcast work. So we recently did a charity event, like a fundraiser. And at the end, one of the people who was there came up to me and brought me her list of every question she's ever sent to Dear Hank and John.
Amazing.
It was an Excel spreadsheet, and it also marked whether we had answered them or not. There were, I would say, 150 questions, and we had answered 4.
That's extraordinary. I love the idea, but I'm also unsurprised by the idea that one of your listeners would have such a spreadsheet.
Just adds another one to it every time.
That's amazing. Those... I wonder whether she considered the 4 questions like better than the other ones, or did she just get lucky, or
I did. What I said was that seems like a pretty good rate to me, and she agreed.
Good.
And
she wasn't there to complain about the 146.
and then but I should have asked, like, what do you think that we picked the good ones? That's a great question.
Yeah, it would be kind of what we call in this country Sod's Law, if it wasn't even questions she was that bothered about, which did make the grade.
Uh-huh.
Because, in the same way that sometimes a tweet gets far more attention than you could have imagined, and you think, why
that
all
one?
The times?
Yeah.
Why that one? Nah. There's a spelling mistake in that one, you idiots.
Now I'm known for that stupid thought that I had.
Now I'm the guy that made one joke about a goldfish and the rest of my canon of work is irrelevant. Yeah.
Well, at least now I can edit tweets. Which is new for me, because I pay for Twitter Blue, which means that I can I can get in there.
I didn't know that was a thing.
If I do something wrong for 30 minutes, I can make a fix. So I'm off the rails now. One's in control.
You must just be tweeting all kinds of racist stuff, knowing it'll only ever have a 30-minute shelf life.
Well, it does keep the edit history, so they can see what you once tweeted.
Right, and of course, people will always be able to screenshot stuff after 1 second, I suppose.
But also, you could always screenshots can always be faked, and I keep that in mind because I often see faked screenshots.
Wow, that isn't. I guess it would have occurred to me, but. That's another level of, God, we're all putting a lot of energy into Twitter, aren't we?
People make fun of me for paying for Twitter with money, but I pay way more with my mental health and time and attention. So
for sure, that seems like a good trade-off. Dare I ask, can anyone have Twitter Blue, or is it available above a certain kind of fame level? Or
anyone can have it with in. But I don't think it's available in every country.
No, I don't think I've heard of it.
But it's available to anybody who wants to pay.
I mean,
in the countries where it's available.
I don't have a particularly bad history with. Like, I would mostly use it just for
typos,
changing spelling mistakes. Yeah,
yes, that's what I have it for.
I believe that's a good use of money. Yeah.
Yeah.
Removing grammatical errors from history.
I went deep on how the edit actually, like the moment I got access to editing my own tweets.
Yeah, bad.
After years of wanting it, I figured out every single way that it works and doesn't work, which it was maybe a little much, but.
Well, you want to know what you're paying for.
Well, interestingly, if you quote tweet or retweet a tweet before I edit it, it stays the old tweet, which I think is a really good way of doing it.
Okay.
So if you retweet my old tweet that has a typo in it, it keeps the typo in your retweet.
It will always be there even after you have edited it.
That's right.
I see.
But then it says, like, this tweet has been edited, and you can see the more recent version of the tweet.
That seems like quite a good compromise, because people's reservation about the edit function is that people could dishonestly change, you know.
And then I've, like, quote tweeted something terrible, not the thing I thought was great.
Yeah, that makes complete sense, actually. Yeah, this seems like quite a good way of doing it, because you can imagine that if you could freely edit tweets forever, 30 minutes gives you a window to do it if you f***ed up, but it doesn't.
Right.
It doesn't allow, for example, dictators to change history.
Yes.
Good. Well, we say a lot of bad things about the Twitter guys, but I think they maybe have nailed that by the sound of it.
I think they've been thinking about this one more than we have.
They will have done
average.
Because for at least 10 years, people have been complaining about the lack of Twitter edit function.
So I'm very glad to have you on the podcast. I'm very glad that you are excited about the questions.
I am.
And I feel like I should just leave you in charge because you are such a connoisseur of quality questions from my Question Asky podcast.
Well, that is, I would say, both an honor and something of a threat, because I don't have them in front of me now, but I can easily get that Google document up.
Okay. Well, I will ask the first one that you highlighted.
That's fine.
From Lucy, who says, "Hey, dear Hank and Mark, my mom just said, if we needed to, we could get ourselves out of a pickle. And my brain took that literally. So I wondered, do you think that if you were stuck inside of a giant pickle, you could break your way out? No such thing as an original thought or sign off, Lucy." I think if I was in a literal pickle, I might be done.
That might be game over for Hank.
That might be it.
I mean, yeah, I think. I liked the question because it reminds me of James and the Giant Peach.
Yeah.
By Roald Dahl, which I think is one of the canonical works where someone is stuck inside food. And I mean, for a start, he has a lot of trouble getting out of that. And a pickle is probably a lot more robust than a peach, right?
Yeah, yeah. And there's like a lot of space in that particular peach for whatever reason, which seems like troubling.
That's true. He has a lot of room to maneuver. I think if you were encased in a giant, it depends on the dimensions of the pickle, doesn't it? If you can't even stand up, then you are in big trouble, I think.
Yeah. I was imagining just completely surrounded, like I've been in a pickle avalanche, like an avalanche, but it's all the inside of a pickle, and now I'm just sort of frozen in whatever shape I'm in. I can't make a new hole.
No, I think then that could be very tough. I feel like
I'm not going to eat my way out because I don't like pickles.
I mean, I don't mind them, but I think I would tire of the task of trying to eat my way out of one quite quickly. Like, yeah, I think I don't mind one in a Big Mac or something, but this is a very different proposition. This is a
what's the thing that you could get stuck in that probably would go okay? Because like, there's definitely on the far side, it's like a can of beans. Can of beans,
yeah.
You're not getting out of that can of beans. That's it. That's the end.
I think if it's a can, then you do have to start thinking about your regrets then. Yeah.
Yeah. And then on the near side, like the best option is cotton candy. Where like I'm stuck in cotton candy, but like my only worry is falling once I get out. Like where?
Yeah.
Like,
your only worry is that the cotton candy is suspended on the edge of a cliff or something and like some ingenious supervillain.
I'm very small. How high up am I?
Yeah. And then you have to have other questions about how you got there in the first place, which I guess is another conversation. You're right. Actually, cotton candy is quite literally the best case scenario here.
Maybe because the best case scenario.
Its texture barely exists at all. Exactly. Uh-huh. So in the middle is maybe stuff like a strawberry, soft fruit, like berries
soft,
and stuff.
Yeah, like, or like a nougat, like a nougaty candy bar. I feel like I could just punch my way out of a nougaty candy bar.
Again, I think I am. Maybe one of the reasons I'm not that into kind of superhero movies and stuff like that is I am too literal minded, and I'm again asking how this came to be in the first place, which is not the not the point of these inquiries, is it? Obviously.
No,
it's like when someone says, "If I put a gun to your head and then ask me to, you know, decide a favorite flavor of chocolate, whatever it is, like my first thing is always, but why such a violent means?"
This seems like a terrible way to extract that kind of information.
This is a massive overreaction. I've never even been silent on this subject.
Why don't you just present me with some chocolate and I'll choose?
If I refuse to talk for years and it's a matter of major importance, then but even then, I don't think it's a gun, is it? You just threaten me with legislation or something.
just be mean, a little mean. Yeah. I'm very weak-willed.
Oh, I'm pretty sensitive. You wouldn't have to get anywhere near a gun before I caved in, But yeah, I think you're right. I reckon even nougat, you're worried that it would be tougher than you. I reckon a lot of things would be tougher to break out if you were encased in them than we imagine.
Right. I mean, like, I'm wondering, am I tiny and it is normal sized, or am I my sized and it is big?
Yeah, as happens.
I guess that shouldn't matter.
No, but instinctively you feel like it does. Like, you feel that
if I was very small, could I punch through nougat? If I'm my size, I definitely can. I've done it before with my teeth.
Of course you have. We've all punched through nougat. Yeah, like, you feel, even though it shouldn't matter, you do feel like it does. You feel like if James had been tiny and in a regular sized peach, he would have been in quite big trouble.
Yeah.
As it was, he was still a boy with the ability. Although, to be fair, I think he got out by making alliances with a load of weird animals and stuff that also were in there, from what I remember.
Yeah, but so he was inside the peach, and there was space in the peach, though.
You could kind of walk around the peach. It was like being in a big tent or something.
So if I ever bit into a peach and it was a normal-sized peach, and like it was like there was a bunch of air inside, I would be really
totally
worried. Like, super worried. I understand it's a giant peach and giant peaches are different.
But you're right. When you bite into a peach, you bank on it all being there, really. All being solid matter. Yeah. Yeah. And I guess.
All right.
But again, I mean, it's not the biggest liberty Roald Dahl took. Like, he was allowed to do that. He had that license.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, definitely. That's how you set yourself up if you're Roald Dahl. You have done that. You have succeeded in that. You can now have a peach with just about anything in there, and it still makes sense.
Totally. And sometimes I envy authors like that who, right from the get-go, their thing is a world like our own. But
let's not worry too much about how things are.
Exactly. If you're allowed to have at least one thing that is completely mad, then you can do that forever then. I'm not saying there's no skill to it, but it's really helpful for plotting if, for example, animals can talk or fruit can get massive.
And just have a big air pocket inside. It's good that it only happens to giant peach, because you wouldn't want to take a bite out of a peach and have a bunch of animals be inside of it.
No, I think in a lot of ways that was what we might call an anomalous peach. Yeah. And
a weird one.
I can't even remember how
the only one of its kind.
Yeah, it got big because of some supernatural happening, which I now can't remember. But again, that's kind of what you expect, isn't it, from a Dahl? Yeah.
It's sort of upsetting that you, one of the leading Roald Dahl scholars, doesn't remember that about the giant peach.
Famously, I've only recently been crowned one of the leading Roald Dahl scholars, as in by you, in the last few seconds. And I kind of feel like it's not one of his absolute top tier books, but it has been probably 30 years since I read it, so that maybe needs to be revisited as an opinion.
All right. Well,
yeah.
What do you got for us?
Anyway, I feel like we've cleared up Lucy's inquiry to some degree.
Yeah, well, you and your mum are dead, and so are me and Mark Watson.
Basically. That might not be what you wanted to hear, but we're not here to make friends, eh? This, I think, is a really interesting question, because it's both very specific and also relates to something we can all identify with. It's from Julia. Dear Mark and Hank, I'm currently stranded 4 hours from home in Washington, D.C. I came here with my dad to hike some trails. His car broke down. It's a holiday weekend, so nothing is open and we're stuck for the time being. This is obviously really frustrating. At this point, I thought it was going to be a query about how to fix her car, which probably this isn't the best way to go about that, writing to a podcast.
No, I would not be able to help with that.
I also wouldn't. And even if we were, I feel like a podcast is a long lead time if your car is broken down. But then she says, I'm trying to remember that this is a first world problem and I'm lucky to have a car to begin with and that we can afford to stay in a hotel a couple of extra nights. But I still have been struggling with this and it's made me wonder, and here is the question, how do you balance gratitude for what you have and validating your own feelings? So great question, I think. How do you get to be a real about your car having broken down while still maintaining, keeping sight of the fact that it's just, nice you've got a car?
Yeah. And look, you're also in our nation's beautiful capital, where there's many things to do, and I hope that you took the chance to not be in the hotel for 2 days straight. Just be like, hey, I guess we're gonna just walk around CDC.
I believe there is some historic stuff in Washington DC, right?
Yeah, we did. We made it the thing. And I couldn't tell you how, but maybe you can after having spent a couple extra days there.
Yeah, that's interesting actually, because it's not even that big a city, is it, compared with a lot of America? Like as capitals go, it's some very good branding, anyway. Some good PR.
Yeah. It's weird to have a city with just a couple extra letters after it too. We don't do that with any of the other cities.
Yeah. Is it there? Is it to distinguish it from the state of Washington?
It's the District of Columbia. So yeah,
right.
I think maybe. And the District of Columbia is famously for Americans one of the only places where you don't have like a representative in Congress
because you're living in Congress almost. Yeah.
There's like a.
I see.
Yeah. There's like a. So you get to vote for stuff and there's like a person you elect who sits there but doesn't get to make decisions.
Oh, that sounds like quite a lot of MPs here, to be fair.
But
not officially.
That is actually also the case for Puerto Rico. It's not, and there's sort of, we have a lot of weird things. We got a lot of weird things.
Your relationship with Puerto Rico is puzzling to an outsider. I will say that.
No, it's puzzling to an insider as well.
Right. Okay, good.
One day, maybe we'll work that out.
Also, occasionally I suddenly remember that you've got Hawaii as well. And I'm like, hang on, what?
But that's a state, normal state. And I'm sorry, but as
it's so far away.
Your relationship with many places is very puzzling.
I know what you mean.
Your monarch is just on the money of Australia?
What are you talking about? We have absolutely no history of claiming places that have got nothing to do with us. As far as I know.
No,
at least I don't remember that from school.
Relationships going on at all.
We have a very secure and normal sense of our own identity in the global village.
Absolutely. And also in the local village where you are, of course, a country made up of several countries.
That's right. None of whom are very happy being with each other. So yeah, everything's going well over here.
Keep it up. we're following it loosely. So, but to the question, I think that like, I err on the side of, just being down on myself
and being
like, well, I have nothing to complain about, just move forward. But I've also seen, plenty of situations where that's super, so I think that it's more about what inspires the most productive action. And so if you're sort of like sitting here being like, well, why I shouldn't be sad about stuff. And that makes you even more sad about stuff.
Yeah. Then that's clearly not a good road to go down.
Don't do that.
Meta sadness.
Yeah. And then you may get more sad about that sad.
I think the fact that she's even posed the question suggests she's on the right path, maybe.
Yeah. I think you're probably pretty good. Most people don't have that.
No, I think if you have the capacity to self-reflection to identify one of your problems as a first world problem, then that puts you ahead of quite a lot of people with them.
That's a nice compliment.
For all we know, she might have been like swearing for 2 days solidly before she sat down and wrote this question.
And she realized, finally, maybe I don't have that much to complain about.
Yeah, it's... But I do think I find it not an easy dilemma because the thing is, almost by definition, all of our problems are first world problems, right? Like anything you do, you could say to yourself, yeah, but somewhat a billion people are without. So at some point you have to still make space for the fact that problems are problems.
Right. And you can also like look back at the first world problems of the past, like the King of France in the 1600s. Had to, you know, carry his own poop in a pot. Maybe he had somebody to pick the poop up, but he had to poop in a pot in his room. There's a whole thing, whole system
for
dealing with that. Hot showers, all kinds of different food available.
Right.
Very nearby.
So basically at any point, there is a better or worse scenario that you could be in. And that's not your fault. It's not our fault that people used to poo in pots and that we don't have to. Well, it's sort of our fault. I guess we could opt out of the current toilet system, but there's nothing in that for us.
No, I don't think it would be good for anybody.
I think that's right. I think it's really important to stay conscious of your responsibilities to other people and to do what you can to narrow inequalities and stuff. But you can't start beating yourself up for the existence of inequalities that aren't your fault and which you have no control over, for a start.
Right. And there's something to the fact that regardless of how bad, how much pain someone else in the world is experiencing, if you stub your toe, if you wrap your toe around the bed, the little legs of your bed, the way that happens in the middle of the night.
In that second, you are in as much and as real pain as anyone. Yeah.
It doesn't matter how anybody else feels. That sucked.
Yeah, that's right.
It's happening to me right now.
Stepping on a piece of Lego is a first world problem because not everyone can afford to buy Lego. But nonetheless, for those 3 seconds, you are the most put upon man in the world. And that's just the way it is. It doesn't matter if the Lego costs £45. Your pain is real. And also, different people's brains do process things in different ways. Some people do have more of a capacity for stoicism than others. It's not purely your fault if you experience quite small sadnesses or problems as quite big things. You can work on it, but still, that's part of who you are. Other people might be very, very resilient and good at dealing with crisis just naturally. So there are a lot of factors, basically. So I think the first world problems is, in a way, a misleading phrase, because if you're not careful, it can give you the idea that none of your feelings are valid, which is the root of the question, and that's not a good place to be.
This next question comes from Annabelle. It's close to my heart. Dear Hank and Mark, I'm a decently smart person, I think, but every now and again someone will be talking about something they know a ton about and I don't know anything about it. It's very confusing. My question is, how do I seem like I'm following someone and understand what they're saying even when I don't? Annabelle. Do you do that?
Do I?
I've stopped doing that.
Well, it's interesting this, because at university, I went to expensive is not right. It's no more expensive than any other university, but it has prestige attached to it. And I felt kind of intellectually inferior to most people when I got there for various reasons. Some of them to do with my brain, and some also I was also right in a lot of cases, because some of them were either mad geniuses or had the kind of schooling where they'd been right. So I spent a lot of my academic career basically doing what Annabelle is describing, appearing to be keeping up with the conversation. And none of that did me much good, except that it is a useful skill in life. So indirectly...
So you actually know how to answer this question, whereas I don't. I'm like, well, no, explain it to me more and better.
Well, actually, I think I also am like that, but I've had to beat that out of myself. I think most of my academic career, inadvertently or not, taught me that being able to... simulate understanding and knowledge is the same as actually having it. And in a way, that's true, as in a lot of people are managed to bullshit their way through all of life, essentially. But as I've got older, I've got much better at saying, I'm sorry, I don't understand. And I think basically the answer to Annabelle's question is, do not ever feel you have to pretend. For a start, and even a listener of one episode of this podcast tells you this, the world is absolutely baffling. The human experience is massive and complicated. You cannot be across more than 1% of everything that's happening. So just be cool with that, I reckon. I've found it liberating as I've got older to just understand that I know almost nothing and don't understand loads of stuff, including some of the sciencey aspects of this podcast. I'm all right with that. You have to be.
Yeah, I feel like I am never trying to... Like, what I don't want to do when I'm in a situation where I am the one who doesn't know anything, I don't want to try and have an opinion or have a perspective. Yeah. I feel like in that situation, I am trying to get them to showcase how, their excitement and what makes them excited about that thing.
Totally, yeah.
And then try and, draw out the things that I'm like, oh, so it would be... Like, I try to rephrase what they said back to them. And I'm like, am I understanding this right? Did you just say that time doesn't exist? Whatever.
Yeah. Well, actually, that is a good example, or weirdly relevant example, because the last kind of science-adjacent book I read was about time.
Oh, God.
Which is a subject that I find very interesting, but also bewildering, obviously. It was called The Order of Time.
I think I read that.
It was a very short book. That's partly why I went for it. Carlo Rovelli, I think the guy's name, right? Mm-hmm. And for about maybe half of it, I was like, all right, I'm just about there.
Yeah.
And then there was a bit where I thought, right, I am gone now. I'm like the guy in the can of beans. I'm not coming back from this. He's lost me. Yeah. But then I found almost a weird beauty in that. Just like, I am totally immersed in your brain here. I can't find my way around it. Mm-hmm. But there's a sort of poetry in just these ideas, whether or not I can really understand them.
Yeah.
Because most people can't do that.
Yeah, I actually think that I stopped that book in the middle, probably in the same paragraph that lost you, where I was just like, I'm done now. What I know for sure is that whatever I think, whatever is sort of like is my instinct about time, is definitely wrong.
Yeah. My take home from most science, even popular science books, is like most of what I know isn't really right. And so that's fine. I was chatting about this with in Australia with the comedian David O'Doherty, who will be known to some people on this podcast, an Irish, brilliant Irish comedian. And we were talking about, we both have this problem with science books where, like, typically it will go, imagine the Earth is a beach ball and the moon is like, you know, whatever, a tennis ball. You're like, okay, fine.
Yeah.
And then the next step is, now imagine someone is holding that beach ball further away and you're like, I'm still just about. And then the third step is always, now, tilt the beach ball on its axis and cut into it like an orange, and immediately you're like, no,
it's too many things. That's too much.
I'm gone, and this is too much. And this is page six, so I feel like I'm in trouble here.
One of the things that I that highlights this for me is the moon, which is there all of the time. Like, it's in the sky half of the time, like almost precisely half. And
we think it's not there, it is.
Yeah, yeah. It's either on the other side of the world or it's just invisible because it's black. because
which
it's
is mad.
And the way that the moon works is it goes around us while we go around the sun. And while that's happening, it's also spinning, but it's keeping its face toward us as it spins. And we are tilted. And with that many variables, one who doesn't think about it professionally actually gets what's going on with the moon and how to say what a lunar month is and why the phases work the way they do.
Someone needs to make, like, someone very clever needs to make a 1-hour Netflix special called What's Going On With the Moon? And which is a definitive statement, a summary, because you're right. It's mad.
And then you'll watch it. And at the end of the special, you'll be like, I understand what's going on with the moon. And then a month later, you won't anymore. You will have forgotten.
Even a day later, you'll already be hazy on quite a lot of it. Yeah. I was talking to someone that remembered the moon landings about how, you know, especially older people felt they ought to be able to look out the window and see the guys, you know, on the moon, on the night that it was happening, when it was on TV and everything. Mm. Like, they're up there, they're on there, why can't? And of course, in a way, that seems like to us like it's an easy thing to laugh at, but it's sort of also, it chimes with something, which is, it is insane we went, that people can even go to the moon. So it's not that insane to think, if they're there, we should be able to see them. It's like, I'm not for a minute trying to get on board with moon conspiracy theories, but I do find it astonishing that people were able to devise a machine that could get there, and with 1960s computers could navigate there. And like, every time I see anything to do with it, I'm like, it's still crazy now, but at least computing is so advanced now that I understand how these calculations could be made.
Yeah.
The idea that in the 60s, it was not to patronize them, but they did really well, I reckon, to get up there.
And then just like no one's ever landed on the moon before. And it's like, that's your job, Neil Armstrong, land on the moon.
It's insane. There must have been a part of them thinking like, it's great to be the first guy, but I don't actually know if I wouldn't mind it being the sixth guy.
To me, being the pressure of not like, if I'm Neil Armstrong or Buzz Aldrin, particularly those two, because Michael Collins is waiting up in the thing, looking down at them.
Collins at least just gets to babysit. Yeah.
If I'm about to land and like, I know that if I run out of fuel, if like I land tilted and it just like rolls over and there's no way to get it right side up.
If I make a fractional mistake of any kind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then all of the work that everybody did to get me here, instead of being a tremendous achievement, is like one of the grandest tragedies in the history of the nation.
Yeah.
Because I just get to die of thirst up here.
Yeah. While America is like fatally set back in the Cold War,
yeah.
and like yeah. generations of human ingenuity. Yeah, it's a first moment in. It's a, yeah.
Me dying at that point is like not that big of a deal.
No,
but like being the cause of the tragedy.
Yeah, like
way too much pressure.
Setting back the cause of the space race. Well, not just the space race, but
totally.
I also feel like
yeah.
When you think how many other people would have wanted that gig, how many other astronauts, yeah. how many generations of people would have dreamed about it, I think the few moments leading up to it, I would have been utterly overwhelmed by that feeling. I couldn't have stopped dwelling on all the people that were... It would be hard enough not even to think about your mum and dad watching or...
Yeah.
But if you then started... I mean, look, I find it stressful. I still find it stressful being on a TV show that a million people are watching, even if it's not live and it can be edited and all of it.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's the definition of one where you can't tidy it up in the edit, I think, the first step on the moon. You really have got to... It's also the definition of something where you really only get one shot.
Yeah. Yeah. Listening to what they talk about, like, there's like the recordings. They don't seem to be thinking about anything except landing the spacecraft, which is a remarkable amount of brain control. It's not like self-control. It's like controlling what your thoughts are doing.
Yeah, this is interesting. I find this very interesting. I spoke to a prominent brain surgeon a couple of years ago, and he said that it, like being a brain surgeon has something in common with being a psychopath because right. again, you don't think I'm cutting it. Like if I cut this, then this guy will never be able to do this again. Or you just purely
doing the thing that you're doing.
I'm doing the thing.
Yeah.
And I would say landing the first ever vessel on the moon is a very extreme example of yeah. doing the thing. Yeah.
Doing the thing. What are you thinking about right now? Just the thing.
I'm just doing my job. It happens though, that my job is to participate in one of the iconic moments of human history, but that's cool. I don't Absolutely. Know what that, maybe it says good things about us, but both of us would have had far too many thoughts to have ever done that job.
Basically. Oh yeah, that's not for me.
That is not for me. Most things aren't for me for this reason. The only job I could do is one where you're actively rewarded for overthinking and where no one else suffers if it goes wrong.
Yep.
Yeah.
Which reminds me that this podcast is actually brought to you by The Thing. The Thing. Doing it is what you're supposed to be doing, but it probably isn't.
Podcast is also brought to you by Lego Pain. If you've had a Lego related accident or emergency, we are here to look after you.
This podcast is additionally brought to you by James and the Giant Pickle. James and the Giant Pickle is Roald Dahl's new classic. It's just a little less sweet and a lot more spicy.
It's amazing they found a new Dahl, isn't it? After all this time. The podcast, in addition, is brought to you by, and this is quite a big coup, I think, as sponsors go, the city of Washington, D.C. Visit America's exciting capital today. To get funding
yeah.
from them must feel great.
I mean, yeah. I think it's really going to take us to the next level.
There must be some like question marks over taxpayers' money going into sponsoring one podcast. But I don't know. That's a matter for you and them, I guess.
As long as the people get up and spend their money in D.C., they're happy. It's all about...
You're very on message with these guys. $5 million will do that, though, I guess.
We also have a Project for Awesome message. This is from the Dutch and Belgium Nerdfighters and friends to Nerdfighters in the Netherlands, Belgium, and far beyond, I guess. Happy 15th birthday to the Project for Awesome. For the past 5 years, we've gotten together with a group of awesome Dutch and Belgian Nerdfighters to digitally reconnect, hang out, and donate during the Project for Awesome. This community has been a big part of our lives, and even though our paths don't often cross, we know that we will always have the P4A. Here's to doing hard things with friends. Even this message was crowdsourced. Nederland, oh Nederland, stage direction sung in the tune of Auld Lang Syne. Okay. Nederland, oh Nederland, oh Nederland, oh Nederland.
I was looking forward to the moment when you realized that was a stage direction and you had to go back and do that. I saw your face change.
It's like, oh, I have to do a thing.
So listen, y'all, you've heard me tell a lot of stories about Policy Genius over the years. Policy Genius, just to be clear, is not an insurance company. It's a marketplace that helps people find and buy insurance. With Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $292 per year for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer same-day approval and avoid unnecessary medical exams. So I know we talk a lot about death on this podcast, and then we use that talk about death to talk about Policy Genius, but for real, for serious, you probably need life insurance, and Policy Genius is a great place to get it. Check life insurance off your to-do list in no time with Policy Genius. Head to policygenius.com or click the link in the description to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. That's policygenius.com. Policy Genius, because you will leave behind people who love and need you. That's not their tagline, but, you know, I like it.
I don't know what time it is where Mark is, but he's just straight drinking a glass of wine.
Oh, that could be any time, Hank. but to be fair, it is almost 8 o'clock here. Okay. At night, I should additionally add.
Thank you for spending your precious evening's time with me.
You're very welcome. During the lockdowns here, there was quite a lot of drinking and also quite a lot of doing podcasts, of course, because not much else was going on. And so I've tended to associate the two things together now as activities.
This next question comes from Sarah, who asks, "Dear Hank and Mark, a lot of people have reply anxiety. They feel anxious when they need to reply to someone, even if it's just a friend. But I get anxious when people don't reply. I can't help but think that they either don't care to talk to me or have been in some horrible accident, even though I know that's irrational. Some of my closest friends have reply anxiety, so this is a problem for me. Is there any way to communicate my needs without diminishing what they are feeling? Anxiously awaiting your response, Sarah."
Yeah.
Sarah, I'm so glad that we got to this, because otherwise we'd just be piling the problems on the problems.
Yeah, this is why I felt we couldn't overlook this question, really, because it's phrased in a way which makes it feel it'd be neurologically inadvisable to skip it.
Yeah.
Also, I think sometimes, it used to be a common trope that people made fun of American like therapy speak and jargon and stuff, because it was seen as a kind of American invention. And now therapy is very widespread, even here, even in this buttoned up country. So, you know, but nonetheless, I think there's something somehow quintessentially American about the idea of one person with reply anxiety and one person with an anxiety about not receiving a reply. The ultimate stalemate emotionally.
So we're going to have to get together, have a meeting of the minds and decide who's got it worse.
Yeah, basically, yeah. Right of way must go to whoever has it slightly worse. Okay. Yeah.
So you obviously can't control other people. You also, to some extent,
yet,
can't control yourself.
Yeah. So actually.
So what we're going to want to do is cut open your friend's brain and put in a little electrode that makes them not worry about this anymore. And now they can reply whenever.
I wondered how long it would be before you got into sort of transhumanism / genetic experiments. Because that is an answer to a lot of these questions. Yeah.
it's all a lot easier if we're not humans anymore.
Sure, if we just...
But just perfectly efficient robot.
If we just sign over some of our humanity to machines, then, as I've been saying for years. It is interesting, this, because this is all of us are constantly in a negotiation between our needs and someone else's. And this is quite a stark example of that dilemma. But I do think communication is half of it. Like, if you know someone is quite nervous if they don't hear from you, then even as somebody with reply anxiety, I reckon you can accommodate that. I reckon this is about both parties understanding exactly what the other's needs are and trying to find a compromise somehow.
Yeah. There also, it has to be that maybe there is some amount of so for example, I don't have reply anxiety. I have a different condition called reply prioritization failure.
Where RPF. Yeah.
Yeah. Where I get a text and then I see it and I think, here's my text that I'm going to send.
But you don't.
And I don't type it or send it.
Totally. I've done that before. Yeah.
And my wife is in particular the greatest sufferer of this quirk of mine.
Yeah.
Because she obviously is the one who texts me the most and also the one who most needs me to text back, probably.
Presumably you're so in tune with her that you automatically assume that you've...
Right.
Done the work when you haven't. I can imagine that.
Sure, that maybe that's it.
It's a positive way of putting it, anyway. Yeah,
but often, so sometimes the text messages are just lovely and don't require a reply. But sometimes they are like, who is going to pick the child up from school today?
And that probably does need a reply, yeah.
Which is, like if several hours go by, the text no longer matters.
I think it's legitimate to have reply anxiety, or no reply anxiety, whatever it is, when it concerns the potential that you're...
When there's an actual task at the end of it, yeah.
Yeah, when your child might be committed to social care if someone doesn't reply, yeah. But that is the thing about the phone, and the way we all live is there is this weird leveling effect where like an important text that needs action like that only carries the same weight on your phone as like some nonsense that someone sent you from Twitter or like, and especially if you're on WhatsApp and things can be coming in every 20 seconds. It is, I think like reply prioritization is something we all have to work quite hard on because the lifespan of a text is so short before something else pops up
And it's a totally new skill. And I think in particular, like the other thing is that I think that there are times when the sort of barrier to action is higher and times when it's lower. And so it's trying to keep conversations like low priority or low stakes with your friends who like what, like, and understanding what, like, because like reply anxiety is a very non-specific term. Maybe there is something more to understand about it there.
Yeah.
And that can be done through communication, whether it's on text or not.
Yeah.
Where you understand what is actually standing in the way and thus being able to empathize more effectively and also to know that this person is probably just, you know, playing Minecraft right now and needs that time to themselves and they are not dead in a ditch.
Right. Everything always comes down to accurately reading other people's needs. But yeah, I wonder if, I mean, probably not us because we're busy, but should someone organize a national reply anxiety conference or something and get all these people together and just like hammer out, except of course the RSVPs would be a minefield. I don't want to be the person monitoring the replies to that invitation.
Yeah, right. It turns out it's just like a big exposure therapy thing where you just have to, all you do all weekend is just reply to things.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
If you RSVP, that means you're already cured and don't have to attend the conference. But if you don't come, that means you should have. It's almost like a catch-22. Yeah. From Amanda, dear Hank and Mark, long-time listener, long-time questioner. Maybe this is the 150 person. I just showed my friends the Rocky Horror Picture Show for the first time. Mm. They didn't like it. Rocky Horror has been one of my favorite movies for years. How do I handle knowing they aren't as cool as I am?
Did it say that?
It does say that. And then she goes on to say, should I just get new friends? Or, and this is the bit which interests me about the question, should I accept that not everyone likes the same weird stuff I do? I think what's interesting is how personally you should take it and how personally we do take it when someone doesn't like something that you like, right? Because it's odd how much of a slight it can feel like.
How deeply do you know the Rocky Horror Picture Show?
Well, unfortunately, I am in the camp of people that our questioner wouldn't get on with. Amanda, my relationship with the Rocky Horror Show is that I was taken at college by a bunch of people who were fans, who were in Amanda's camp, and I didn't really know much about it. Mm-hmm. I was just made to wear a short skirt and fishnet tights, which was fine. That part I enjoyed. I don't know what I thought it was going to be, but obviously what it was an evening of people yelling out catchphrases that I couldn't have anticipated, didn't understand. So and I've never really revisited it. So actually my memory of Rocky Horror is also that I didn't like it, but I didn't like it because I was with people who did like it.
Specifically, you got thrown into the deepest deep end and it was like, swim, boy!
That's right. And it wasn't even a film, I should add. It was a live performance of it, which meant if anything, there was even more interaction encouraged, but not in a way that an outsider could really understand. So yeah, basically, I think if you are a fan of cult stuff, you have to accept that people on the other side of that,
there's a reason.
Yeah, there's a reason, right? And a part of the joy of being in a cult fandom is that other people don't quite get it, right? That's just how it is.
Right. Famously, the Rocky Horror Picture Show is a bad movie.
Right.
Like there are ways in which it is good, but like, and for a bad movie, it has a surprising amount of ways that you can enjoy it.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that someone coming to it anew...
It's still a bad movie.
Right.
With some pretty good songs. But it is enjoyed in the way where like you... like expose yourself to it so much that you start to see the ways that it's good. But I think in the beginning, it was consumed because it was funny to watch this bad movie over and over again.
Right.
And I've seen Rocky Horror probably 30 times. So I am in there. I was in a Rocky cast once. Like I've done.
You're the other side of it from me. Right.
Yeah.
So there you go. That's a good insight, I think. Like if something becomes a cult thing because of the baggage of that people have put on it and that feeds off itself, then it's almost impossible to expect somebody to enjoy it without any of that history, I reckon. I guess the question was flippantly asked, but it definitely doesn't mean that you should get new friends. I think there's something cool about friendships where you just accept that there are things you simply don't agree on or want to consume together. Not everything, or you probably wouldn't be friends, but
yeah,
it's healthy to have like huge artistic disagreements, I reckon, within a friendship.
It's also great if you can have some Rocky Horror friends. And some not Rocky Horror friends.
Yeah, like
that's totally all right.
You don't want everyone to be a Rocky Horror friend, surely.
Yeah. What we certainly don't want is for everyone to like the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yeah.
I think that would definitely ruin it.
Right, because again...
And I love it. I just think that it's bad.
Right.
Like, it's objectively not a good movie for a lot of reasons. And then there are also, inside of this bad movie, some tremendous performances.
Totally.
And... some very weird moments.
And again, with any phenomenon like that, it means that a very specific percentage of people will love it. And that percentage should never be higher than it is, because that's how cult things happen. If, as you say, if everyone loved it, the cult would have no oxygen. There'd be no fun in it. It's, you know, you have to identify within a fandom like that as we're the guys that get it. And for that to happen, other people have to exist that don't. So actually, I think your friends have done the right thing by not enjoying your favorite thing.
Yes. And you need to release the pressure from them and be like, that is fine. Do I feel in my deepest heart that I'm cooler than you and that I really wished you liked this? Yes.
Yes.
But I'm letting that emotion go.
Precisely.
I'm not holding on to it.
It's a good exercise.
I feel it, and I let it go, because different people are different. And that if we weren't, it would be a really boring world. Before we get to the news from our Mars and AFC Wimbledon, I'm going to ask this question from Lucia, who asks, it says, howdy, I just started my freshman year at Barnard College and I only have one friend. That's great, but she keeps calling my home state of Illinois, Illinois. Like she pronounces the S at the end. She has been doing this for 2 months now and I die inside every time. How do I tell her that she's pronouncing the state incorrectly? And she has been for her entire life without losing the one and only friend I have on the East Coast. Lucia.
I think this is great, especially the only friend I have on the East Coast put such a bleak framing on the question. The thought of those thousands of miles.
Yeah, it's a lot of people, then it's only one.
This is a famous, like, a textbook example of a social anxiety causing problem. Like, the typical one is someone is calling you by the wrong name and it gets to a point where it's been 8 years and there's nothing you can do about it. But I feel like this is... Can't this be rectified by just her saying Illinois in the correct way several times in conversation, like just naturally?
Well, yeah, it could be another thing, which is that the person knows that they are pronouncing it incorrectly and it's just like the way that they say it.
Right, okay.
There are people... There are words like this that we do. I had a friend who said peschetti instead of spaghetti.
Right.
Which is kind of like the keto word for spaghetti. Because it's hard to say, so you say peschetti.
And so you just hang on
but
to it.
But he just grew up.
Yeah.
He just grew up and he's like a 45-year-old man who says peschetti. And I'm like, okay.
Yeah, it's too late. It's too late to change this. He knows.
This is done.
This is not about awareness. This is something else.
Either I learn to love this, or I can't hang out with this person when spaghetti's nearby.
So that's an interesting aspect to the question. What if it's a known thing, and that like could she still love this person if the Illinois thing is some sort of affectation or tic
or
habit?
Here's my suggestion: you start saying other states wrong,
and see what happens.
Yeah. Call Arkansas Arkansas,
which is what most of us do here. Yeah, or just a really weird one like Ohio or something. Like,
yeah, yeah. Ohio.
Ohio. Yeah.
Ohio is great.
Just try saying like New York and New Mexico with the emphasis on the new, and see how long that comes before it becomes a conversation point. Yeah. And then when she bites, go, all right, what about this Illinois bush?
Yeah, I was like, oh, let's go. Since I'm also having trouble, since I'm having trouble with pronunciations of states, and also you have to seed Illinois in there. You start referring to Illinois as Illinois,
Illinois.
And then she says, that's wrong. And then you say, oh, I didn't know. Let's look it up. I think I'm right. And
all
then
right.
It turns out you're both wrong.
That would be a very generous way of doing it, actually. So there's no blame. There's no, and also, yeah.
Ah, it's like a tie. It's like, oh.
It's a tie. And we put it behind us. Yeah.
Yeah, the great Illinois tie.
I'm just wondering, I don't know quite how this helps, but there's Sufjan Stevens made that album called Come On Feel the Illinois as well as a deliberate
maybe
joke.
That's what happened.
Like I can't, and it's a great album. I can't help wondering if, I don't know if these people are into the right kind of music, but that might be a conversation starter. That's all I'm saying. There's a piece of work out there which plays on the Illinois thing already. But yeah, this is, of all the dubious advice we've given, I feel like this might actually work. This is a solvable problem in a way that some of them maybe aren't.
There's something there.
Yeah, yeah, there's something there. We've helped.
You may just be an Illinois household now. Like if enough people called it Illinois, it would just be the word.
Yeah.
Because it's not like
eventually.
Yeah, it's not like the original word Illinois.
No.
Well, now I'm stuck.
Usage in the end dictates how we do these things. So
that's right.
Yeah, that's, will your friendship with this person survive a cultural shift where Illinois is actually correct, and then that's a massive climb down?
Mm-hmm.
I think probably not, because she did say I die inside every time. So I think there's a fair bit emotionally riding on this that there maybe shouldn't be.
It's a little bit like having something in your teeth, incorrectly pronouncing a state for the whole of your life. And you do, someday you do need to find out about the thing in your teeth, one way or another.
Totally. So however the situation plays out, it is for the greater good of these people, I think. This can't go on forever. Yeah.
You have to pretend like it's the first time you heard, though, and like you haven't been thinking about it. Like next
totally.
Time she says Illinois, you're like, did you say Illinois?
Yeah, and if this friend is a listener to this podcast, then the game really is up. But I guess she's factored that possibility in.
It's a send them the podcast. All right, what's going on in English football?
I don't need to tell you probably that AFC Wimbledon suffered a disappointing defeat at the weekend, but I think they're still doing all right, basically.
Do you? Because yeah. They're not winning a lot of games.
Yeah, no, actually, I'll revise that. They're not doing great. But I would say that they're kind of below where one would want to be at this stage of the season. But the thing is, I support quite an unsuccessful football team. And so I don't really regard it as going badly unless things are properly, as Americans would say, in the toilet. So where AFC Wimbledon are in their league, which I think is 17th or something like that now, is roughly similar to where my team are in a different league, but nonetheless. And I don't yet regard this as a problem. I'm just kind of wearily strapped in for another year of struggle. If that's your mentality.
What league is your team in?
Well, actually, again, this is a first world problem. My team is in the championship, so the second tier of English football. So compared with the Wimbledon fan, I'm in a good situation. But I still spend most of my time, most of 35 years now, dealing with, broadly speaking, disappointing results. So, and between fans like that, there is a real kinship because a lot of, you know, fans of huge Premier League teams feel as if life is really tough for them. And all they mean is, like, they haven't won a trophy for 6 months or something. If you haven't won anything ever, like, my team has only ever won maybe 5 or 6 trophy titles in like 100 years. So you do kind of, and quite often fans of super clubs like Manchester United who go through a bit of a dry spell, commentators, pundits will say, yeah, these fans are so patient. They've been through such hardship. There's this. And to people like us, that is obviously insane. So basically,
realize that that the teams in the second league have stadiums with fans in them.
Yeah. But there are 25,000 of us that would kill for like one minute as a Manchester United fan. Yeah. So, yeah, I would say that it's been a slightly rocky start this season for Wimbledon, but I suppose my overarching point is there is kind of a glory in just sticking at it. I also don't think, as some people might know, what everybody really fears is if you finish in the bottom two, you drop out of the league altogether, and that would be a disaster. But I think they'll comfortably stay clear of that trapdoor.
That is the fear. Well, this week in Mars News, the InSight lander is trying to survive as a dust storm bears down upon it. NASA first saw the dust storm happening on September 21st. is how you say that word, letter, number. It's a number.
This is like the Illinois thing again. Yeah.
Firthed. So they saw it via, from space. They were looking down and they saw a dust storm happening on Mars. It didn't seem to be having a lot of impact on the lander because it's quite a ways away, but the storm has kept growing and filling the atmosphere with dust. And now it's beginning to impact the amount of sunlight that's reaching the lander's solar panels. So that has lowered the amount of energy that it can use from 425 watt hours per sol, which is a day on Mars, to 274. So nearly halved. To conserve energy, the lander's turned off the seismometer, which will hopefully allow it to keep working for a bit after the storm is over. But that means it can't get any data right now. But the team behind the mission has estimated the mission might end sometime between the end of this month and January 2023, depending on how much dust accumulates on the solar panels. So InSight has been trucking for a while now, but it's going to be a shorter mission than we are sometimes used to with these stellar performing rovers.
Again, you see, when we talk about like levels of stress in a job, I feel like that's quite a big problem. A dust storm on Mars is threatening my expensive equipment. I'd be like, right, I don't know how much I can really do about this.
But look, my car broke down.
Yeah, right. You might be stuck in Washington, D.C., but there's a thing that's stuck on Mars with a dust storm engulfing it. Yeah.
But at least it's not me. I can breathe the good old Earth air with all of its oxygen, and it's fantastic.
Oh, we have great air.
Such good air.
I mean, most of it isn't anymore, but still.
Quite a bit of it is less good than it once was. It's all 100% of it is better than Mars air.
For sure. We're still galaxy leaders in that regard. As far as we know, okay.
That is unclear. I don't know what air I would prefer, honestly. This is the air that we evolved for. So in terms of our usage of it, probably we are galaxy leaders.
Surely. It would be hard to imagine something better for us than oxygen, right?
Yes.
But if anyone's got anything, then we'll give it a go.
Well, too much oxygen actually would be bad, but you don't want to get me started.
Oh, that's right. Air is composed of several different gases, isn't it? Yeah, okay.
It's mostly nitrogen and oxygen. All right. Yeah, almost entirely. And it's mostly nitrogen, which is weird because it does nothing. It just is soup for us to walk around in and keep the planes up.
Which is important, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, without all the nitrogen, it would be much harder to fly planes. I hadn't ever thought about that.
Oh, there you go. Good old nitrogen. We don't often think about it, but it's doing so much work for us.
Thank you, Mark Watson, so much for coming on the podcast. Do you have anything that you want to tell people about?
Well, I suppose I'll just ask them to find me on Twitter if they would like to, which is @WatsonComedian. And then from that, in turn, is a portal to the many things that I occupy my life with. That's probably the best way.
Oh, the different places that we can go and consume your content.
Although, of course, I'll be editing those tweets from now on. Now I know that's a thing.
There's also, I Googled you at the beginning of this to see if there's anything I should share. And the top question is Mark Watson Emma Watson's brother?
Right. And the odd answer to that is I am not the brother of the famous star Emma Watson, but I do have a sister who is called Emma and I who's now married, at least, so she has a different surname. But for the first 30 or so years of her life, I'd say about once a year, a weirdo would get in touch with me, hoping that I could put him in touch with... not for the first 30 years, from whenever the Harry Potter movie started, yeah. I've certainly... A troubling number of people out there think that I am the answer to them meeting Emma Watson, the actor.
That's troubling on a number of levels.
It really is, yeah, a number of levels. The main one is that I do not have the moral right to traffic Emma Watson or facilitate hookups with her, but... again, the main argument against it, as I say, is that I'm not in touch with that Emma Watson.
That's good to know.
My sister Emma's great, but I don't think that's what those people are after.
Right. I'm glad that we got that out at the end of the podcast so people wouldn't be confused.
Me too. I was trying to guess what the first question was going to be there.
That's what it was.
When you started with Ismail Watson. There you go. It could be a lot worse than that, I think.
If you want to send us questions, the place to do that is hankandjohn@gmail.com. And you can impress Mark with what clever questions you have.
The pressure is on that, yeah.
This podcast is edited by Joseph Tunamedish. It's produced by Rosianna Hals-Rojas. Our communications coordinator is Brooke Shotwell. Our editorial assistant is Debuki Chakravarti. The music you're hearing now and at the beginning of the podcast is by the great Gunnarola. And as they say in our hometown,
don't forget to be awesome.